And colleagues, we're going to do a work session on introduction of speaker-approved bills first, and then just go in line with the agenda. First have a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 103, then House Bill 2857 and Senate Bill 456. And you might notice something a little different on the agenda as well. We have some different administrators named for each of the bills. And this is something that we found worked very well with the Rules Committee last session, in that those bills that are coming over from different committees here at the end of session, it makes it a lot easier for the administrators who dealt with that on those committees is able to follow it through with us, kind of help answer questions and put it through the process a bit. And it also relieves our own administrator of that work as well. So I'm always happy to help.
Well, I have to tie myself to most of the bills in committee.
That's true.
Mr. Chair, I think this comes under the rubric of not reinventing the wheel.
Right. That's it, exactly. So with that, let's go ahead and open up a work session on introduction of speaker-approved bills. Let's see, what's there for us?
Mr. Chair, I move Legislative Council Draft 3659 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Flores has moved Legislative Council Draft 3659 introduced as a committee bill. Discussion, colleagues, first, yeah, this is the sign-and-die resolution for the end of session, and the Senate actually had introduced theirs last week, being a little bit more optimistic maybe than we are, being a week behind, but, you know, I thought it was a good time today to do this, given that the original deadline for sign-and-die was June 6th, and we know we're not going there, but you know, we did want to have the bill ready at the moment's notice that it's needed. Mm-hmm. So, further discussion, Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if the Chair knows what the items go in the blanks.
You know, the way it reads is that it is open for discussion later, but I'm actually interested in maybe sending this around to all members and let them fill it in and see what kind of response we get. Other questions? Other discussion? Okay. Seeing no further discussion, any objection? If not, so ordered. And we'll close the work session and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 103. And we'll ask Megan Palau to come forward. And Cheryl Pellegrini, come forward, please.
That's an easy one to support.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice, Assistant Attorney General assigned to the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section. Senate Bill 103 was proposed by my section. It was, and I don't know if Mr. Fuller of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association is going to be here or not. He did testify on the House side and participate in amendments on the House side. The bill essentially does three things. Oregon, in 1999, the legislature adopted Oregon's anti-bushing bill, and that's found at ORS 646877. A bushing is basically, it's a practice by unscrupulous car dealers whereby a dealer will sell a consumer a car, let them take it off the lot on the spot, take their car as a trade-in, and then begin to shop around the contract for the new car to creditors. Often what would happen is the dealer would sell the consumer's trade-in before obtaining financing for the new sale. If the dealer couldn't obtain financing for the new sale, they would call the consumer back in and tell them that their choice was either to have no car or to sign a contract with a higher interest rate because they couldn't obtain financing at the rate stated in the original contract. That's bushing. The law in 1999 outlawed that practice. In working with the bill over the past couple of years, both the Attorney General's office and the car dealers have noticed that there are a couple of provisions in there that could bear some improvement, and that's what Senate Bill 103 does. First, what it does is that it provides a dealer with incentive to obtain financing within a certain period of time. And it does this by providing that if the dealer can't get the car financed, the sale financed within 20 days, then they certainly can continue to try to obtain financing after 20 days. But what they cannot do is continue to charge the consumer for mileage on the car, which is what they're now allowed to do. So it provides an incentive without actually requiring them to do so. The second thing that the bill does is it addresses a problem, and this is just one with more the way the insurance industry works, whereby lenders will often give initial approval and then final approval. And often if information comes in between initial approval and final approval, there may be no final approval. And what was resulting here is that car dealers and consumers who gave the information that they had left the initial deal thinking that they had a final sale, only to find out later that a lender would not give final approval, and it put both the lender and or the dealer and the consumer in an awkward spot. So the second thing that SB 103 does is that it requires the dealer to hold the consumer's trade-in and not to move forward on anything until it obtains final approval from the lender on the terms that were originally negotiated. The final point that Senate Bill 103 covers is that the law becomes applicable to lease transactions as well as sales, and there's no real good policy reason to cover one and not the other. It's just that in 1999, when the bill was originally passed, leases were just beginning to become popular in terms of a transaction. So that's what Senate Bill 103 does. The Attorney General's Office worked with both the Oregon Auto Dealers Association and the Independent Auto Dealers Association. I don't believe that there's any objection or opposition to the bill in its current form, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I do need to declare to you that I am part of an automobile dealership and owners. I guess I don't see anyone here from either of those organizations, which I'm very familiar with, so I presume that they don't oppose it. I guess I'm kind of curious. I'm not as familiar with this. Is this a widespread problem, Cushing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it certainly was in 1999 when the law was first passed, and I can tell you that in the intervening 3 years since we've been working with this law, we have taken some cases. I think that one benefit that having this on the books has done, it provided for both consumers and for dealers, is that it's put everybody on notice about how these transactions should unfold. Right. And I think that sometimes dealers sold trade-ins assuming that initial financing was going to turn into final approval, and that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so we, both the dealers and the Attorney General's Office, believes that this provides a good, clear, detailed map for both the industry and the public about what to expect in a transaction involving a trade-in.
Mm-hmm. A follow-up. I certainly have no objection to any restrictions that you put on keeping people honest and in doing good business. I would say that I'm not familiar with this particular thing. I think sometimes people get who are selling, regardless of what they're selling, can become overly enthusiastic. That sounds like some of what that might be, trying to get people out the door and into the cars and, you know, rushing the process too much. Good business really demands, though, that you really don't even know the profit picture until the used car is sold. And that means the new car has been financed. So it's a very poor business practice to begin with, much less whether it's legal or not. It's poor business. Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Daryl Fuller.
Well, there is somebody.
Mm-hmm. New car dealer.
I just spoke too soon.
Perhaps Mr. Fuller was hiding in the back.
I know, I didn't see him.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I apologize for my tardiness. Daryl Fuller, the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. I want to indicate our support of the bill as amended. The original bill as introduced by the Department of Justice was one that we opposed, and as it was originally conceived, a deal would have been void after 20 days, even if a factory or lending institution had approved the loan after 20 days. We would not have been able to continue the deal after 20 days. It just set a drop-dead date that deals had to be done. And we had some concerns with that when a customer's been sent out and they were in the car and were waiting for approval, and we call them back and say, it doesn't look like we're going to get approval, and it's gone past 20 days. And by the time they get the car back, if it had already been approved, we would have to tell them, well, it was approved, but it's not because of the statute. And what usually happens in these cases, well, about probably 99% of the cars that are sent out with customers pending approval of their loan, 99% of those get done within the first 48 hours. Those are generally deals that are done on the weekend when the banks aren't open, and they can get a conditional approval based on their credit scoring and other things. So we know the loan's going to get bought, but we just don't have final approval. Excuse me. Where we get into trouble is when the banks look at the application on Monday or Tuesday, if they happen to verify the employment history, and the person said they've been there for 5 years and they've only been there for 3 years, and all of a sudden red flags start to be raised, and so the lending institution starts asking for more information from the customer. So then we have to contact the customer, and they have to get the information to us, and we have to get to the lending institution. So in rare cases, it can take 2 weeks or 3 weeks to get all the information you need. And I had a dealer, as we were talking about this at our legislative committee, who was saying, I just sent a customer out the door. I just bought a brand new car for his wife before he left for Iraq. I'm not going to be able to reach him for a year. You know, so if his contract were to come back with questions, I don't want to have to go back and repossess the car from the wife, because I'll hang it out there for a year if I have to, because he's out doing his thing. Now, obviously, that's a very rare exception. But we weren't comfortable with a 20-day limit, and then the deal had to be unwound. And the concern that the Department of Justice had was the notion that somebody could be out there for a long period of time, and then if they couldn't get bought, the contract couldn't be bought, that when they returned the car, the dealer would be able to charge the customer for mileage. And if you're talking 30, 40, 50 days out there, the cost of the mileage that the customer now owns the dealership could become a pretty high amount. And if that could be used to coerce the customer to buy the car at a higher rate. And we're opposed to that practice, obviously, as well. So what we decided as a compromise was to take the incentive out of having the customer in the car for long periods of time, which would allow the dealer to charge the customer a large amount of money. And so by saying if the car isn't recalled because of the funding problem within the first 20 days, that the dealer then can't charge them for any of it, not even the first 20 days. And so that takes the incentive of delaying a customer on the approval. So we think this is a good compromise in the best sense of the regulator and the regulated getting together and understanding that a problem exists and finding a solution that everybody can agree to. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Evidently not. Did a good job, evidently.
Ring the bell.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate the testimony. Seeing nobody further to testify on this bill, we will close the public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 103. Representative Forrest.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 103 as amended. Senate Bill 103 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 103 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, call the roll.
Representative
Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Reinhardt.
Aye.
Representative
Post. Both aye.
Representative
Flores. Aye.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative
Gerber. Aye.
And Chair
Dora. And Chair votes aye. And Without objection, move this to the consent calendar. Seeing none, so ordered. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 103. And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2857 and ask Patrick Brennan to come forward as administrator and ask Representative Bates to come forward. Welcome, Representative. This came from the floor back to our committee. And you can help us explain.
Yes, for the record, Alan Bates, Representative from District 5 Ashland. And this is concerning House Bill 2857, which came before to this committee. And I'd like to give you a quick background on it, a little information about the bill. And I'll tell you that I'm truly working across the aisle with this bill. This bill primarily affects a district that used to be a part of my district, which is now in George Gilman's district, and the problem that's arisen in that district over the last several years has become sort of a small piece of a war going on in Southern Oregon over taxation without representation. Okay. Way back in the mid-1970s, a transportation district was formed in the Rogue Valley, which was designed initially to include a town called Eagle Point. Ultimately, Eagle Point never got any regular service from that. The towns of Ashland, Phoenix Talent, and Medford and Central Point, all of which probably seems like a strange group of towns to you, did get that service, and it has been in place for the last 20 years or so and done well. When Eagle Point first was involved in this back in 1975, it was exempted out from this to a great degree. But there were parcels of land inside the city boundary, which the boundary then grew around, which were not exempted out. So now we have a situation where we have a small community in which people can live next door to each other. One person is paying for the transportation district. The next person is not paying for the transportation district. And nobody's getting any service, and nobody expects getting service in the foreseeable future. According to state law, if there's no chance for foreseeable service in the future, you can be exempted out. But since that opportunity always exists on a foreseeable basis, you can't say zero to it. The county commissioners have not felt free to exempt out those parts of the county that get no service. And county assessor has not been able to do that, and the board itself, which wishes to do it, can't do it. This bill answers a very specific question for the Rogue Valley and the Rogue Valley only. It's written so it doesn't affect the rest of the state. There are problems with TriMet. There are problems with Lane County if you don't make it very specific just for the Rogue Valley. As far as we know, there's no other part of the state that has this problem. I think the Rogue Valley is just big enough to have a transportation district, but not big enough to solve some of these problems. That's in a nutshell what this bill does, and that's why it says some very strange things about Roseburg and Meridians and all kinds of things. We wanted to put this in a situation where it only affected Rogue Valley. The people in the valley are quite concerned about this. It's something that's on the talk shows all the time, and it's heated up, I think, somewhat past its real significance. But the bottom line is, those people needed to be exempted out, are not being able to be exempted out, and there's no opposition locally to it. They just want to be able to do it legally and get it done.
One of the things, too, Representatives, and welcome Representative Gilman as well to the podium, but one of the things that at least we're trying in practice is that when this has been heard by a substantive committee elsewhere and it's just being returned to the Rules Committee for technical changes, is that's where we want to focus, is what the technical change is that then is allowed to get this back to the floor. So if you have any comments on that, the committee appreciate that.
Essentially, Mr. Chair, we found that in the initial bill we'd written, it was too broad and would affect, or potentially could affect TriMet, it could affect Lane County, and we didn't want that to happen. And so after we got input from them, as well as the special districts, we came up with the language you're seeing in front of you, which specifically names the Rogue Valley, and so none of the rest of the state can be affected by it. It's not opposed, this language is not opposed by the county assessor, the transit district in the Rogue Valley, nor the county commissioners. In fact, they're all asking for this bill as we sit here and speak today.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In effect, the A4 amendments, which I assume is what we're talking about, do not actually amend the statute that deals with this general issue at all, do they? They simply establish this particular case so that you can take care of this particular problem, and then the whole thing goes away, if I understand it correctly, in 2006.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate you noting that, because this is going to take care of the situation. 2 years from now, we won't need it anymore.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. And members, we do have a member of the Oregon Transit Association. If you needed any questions answered, I'm assuming we don't. No? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2857 and open up a work session on 2857. Representative Lois Anderson, can you move adoption of the dash A4s?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A4s to House Bill 2857.
Representative Monis Anderson has moved dash A4s as, or the amendments dash A4 to House Bill 2857. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2857A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Moss Anderson has moved House Bill 2857 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Can you call the roll?
Representative
Backlund?
Aye. Representative
Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Close?
Excused.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Berger?
Aye.
And Chair votes aye. Representative Bates, who was carrying this before, do you know?
Cromwell.
Oh. Okay. Representative Gilman will be the carrier. And that closes the work session on House Bill 2857. And we now open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 456. And Senator Morissette, come forward. Appreciate your patience, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you for hearing the bill. For the record, my name is Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. I'm here today to present what I hope is compelling reasons to pass Senate Bill 456. This bill, and you'll hear testimony from others that is perhaps even more compelling than my testimony, is a bill that deals with protection of children and protection of the parents' rights in dealing with their children. The bill is a very simple bill, and Section 1 prohibits a teacher, administrator, counselor, nurse from recommending that a student seek prescription for medication that's prescribed to the intent affecting and altering the thought process, mood, behavior. Section 2, however, goes on to make it very clear that nothing in this section prohibits a kindergarten through 12 school personnel from communicating with a parent or a legal guardian or student concerning the behavior of the student. Now, the purpose of this bill is to not have the school staff diagnosing the student. They are in no position to diagnose the cause of behavior. And so what this bill tries, what this bill does is it makes it very clear that they can and should meet with the parents and discuss the behavior in terms of what, describing behavior. Your student is non-attentive, your student is out of control, your student is disruptive, and you need to have your student examined to see if there is a medical reason for the behavior. There's some interesting behavior that goes on that is makes it difficult to tell if the student is acting out because of a some sort of a deficiency or because the student is indeed very bright and very bored. And there's a lot of anecdotal information from many people who have said, you know, my student or my child, you know, the school tried to get me to put my child on drugs, but I refused, and I took him to the doctor, and the doctor or the psychologist or psychiatrist upon examination concluded that that wasn't the problem. The problem was that child was not being stimulated, and therefore the child was acting out in similar types of behavior to someone who has attention. Maybe the child did have attention deficit, but it wasn't for a medical reason. It was because the child was bored. And so this, that's the purpose of this bill, and I think it's very important, and you will hear further testimony to give examples of why I think that this bill is necessary. Now, you will hear later also another testimony that this could be done through administrative rule. And my problem with administrative rule is administrative rule comes and goes. It may not always be followed. I think a statutory direction for administrative rule is important. And having it in statute, I think, sends a message that this is a very important thing that must be followed. It's a indication of something that should not be going on in the school. So therefore, I do argue for statutory language rather than an administrative rule. So with that, I will end my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Morissette, for bringing this bill to us. I note in some of the materials I found in my file that there's a pending a federal bill, H.R. 1170, in which there's a requirement similar to this one. Would SB 456 comply, establish Oregon's compliance with that bill if it were to pass?
Yes, and I appreciate your mentioning that. There was a bill that did pass Congress, 425-1, that does require states to have this kind of a direction. It will also be argued that administrative rule can do this, but I believe that the statutory language is preferable to that, and 16 states are in the process of either having passed something similar to this or passing it. Now, this federal legislation, if it is enacted, would require that states have something in place that to protect the child and the parents from denying a school a child entrance admission to a school because they did not take drugs. So yes, this would definitely be in compliance with the federal legislation if it does pass, which I'm sure it will.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Morissette, I believe in your district you had the Kip Kinkle shooting, and I believe that I read that he was on certain drugs, including Ritalin. Can you just tell us if this influenced your legislation?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Close, it didn't. In the Kip Kinkle case is an interesting, very complex case because both of the parents were teachers, both of them were at the same school, both of them were killed by the student. There were a lot of issues, variables that played into that. I didn't see that as my motivation for this legislation at all. So I think it's a different issue.
Can you tell us, was it confirmed that he was on drugs?
No, it's interesting, there was an article in the Register Guard shortly after that, and a university professor, Dan Close, who works with violent children, had a conversation with Kip Kinkle's father in the San Francisco airport, urging that he do some of the things that needed to be done in terms of understanding the behavior patterns of his son. Apparently, that may or may not have happened. I think I'm not sure what the motivation of the parents was at the time in dealing with the child. And There obviously was some mental condition there that I don't think was dealt with properly.
Thank you.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In order to understand this bill a little bit better, are you just aware of specific instances where a teacher told a parent that your child needs to be on a medication? Make sure you do that. I mean, to me, it's sort of hard to visualize a professional teacher doing that.
Well, I think you'll hear some anecdotal information from other people who testify there. I have heard a lot of anecdotal information there. We heard from some parents in Klamath Falls that told us that we were told and that they were told that they could not return their child to school unless they had the medication. We made phone calls and found that was not entirely true. There was a strong recommendation that they put their child, there were several families, on drugs, but there was never a threat not to accept the children without the medication, so that turned out not to be true. But the strong recommendation is almost intimidation. Either you do this or you're in trouble. And that's what we want to prevent. We don't want teachers diagnosing. We want teachers to describe behavior. Your child is a behavior problem. You have to address the problem. You should have your child examined. You should look at medical causes, perhaps. And it has to be a non-threatening kind of discussion. The discussion absolutely has to take place. And I think the second section of this bill addresses that yes, if there is a behavior problem, as a teacher for 30 years, I would not allow a child in class who was disruptive. And I had various ways of dealing with that. I didn't ever require that he be put on or even suggest that. I found other ways of doing it, in dealing with the parents and dealing with the child in a non-classroom setting. It has to be done. I would not have a child in class who was disruptive for whatever reason. But the discussion has to be objective and non-diagnostic. I would never suggest to a parent that their child needed medication. I think that just didn't enter my mind, and I don't think that's my place to do that. I would definitely emphasize why that child should not stay in the classroom because of the disruption.
So you're saying that this legislation is needed because teachers aren't aware of that?
Well, I think there is a tendency and to perhaps assume that it is attention deficit that requires Ritalin or some similar drug to fix the problem, and that may not be the case. And the case could be a misdiagnosis, so to speak, of the child's unattention because of boredom, and the child is very intelligent and the child is not being challenged. And that is what we hear a lot. We hear, in fact, in our committee, the same day we were hearing this bill, we heard a group of parents of TAG students who were concerned about lack of funding for the TAG program, and they were listening to the testimony, and some of them then sent me material to support the position that I was making. And so I think it is fairly common among, well, I don't know how common, but it does occur when children are bored for whatever reason. Now, that's the kind of behavior you should be talking about. Your child is not paying attention. Your child is, and you can list the actions, but you can't diagnose. You cannot say your child should be put on a drug. That's up to the doctor. You can say your child should be examined by a professional to make a determination of what the problem is.
And then one further.
Sure, follow up.
This bill basically says you can't recommend, a prescription, and a physician is the only one who can really diagnose, and a physician is the only one who can actually prescribe a medication. I'm just surprised that this bill is needed, because the prescription could not be given to a parent.
Well, what may happen is that a parent is told that the child needs a prescription. The parent goes to the doctor. The parent says, "My child, I need a prescription because my child is acting out in the class," and the doctor, without really examining, takes the parent's word for it and prescribes something for the child. And that is the danger, that the parent should not go to the doctor assuming that there is a medical problem, that the parent should go to the doctor and asking for his opinion about, why is my child misbehaving? Is there a medical problem? Not, there is a medical problem. And that's why I don't think the parent should be told that child needs a prescription.
Further. Sure. I agree with you, Senator, that you shouldn't be telling a parent that the child needs medication, because mental and behavioral health is an extremely complex issue, and I would be remiss and to know of a physician that would just prescribe a medication because the parent said the teacher wanted it, but that's all.
Representative Barnhart?
Well, I was going to wait for other people to testify, but then I realized that the senator does have a lot of experience as a teacher, and you probably do know the answer to these questions. I guess I'm concerned because I'm very well aware of the complexity of the diagnosis of ADHD, and even if the diagnosis is reached, what the proper treatment is, because it's not always obvious to anyone what that is. And I guess you're certainly familiar with the reality that behavioral problems are multi-determined and that there's a lot of causes for them. And sometimes it's not easy to tease out what all the causes are.
I agree.
If I understand your bill correctly, and what you're trying to accomplish here, what you really want is to prevent a shorthand, that is, your kid needs medication, to substitute for a real diagnosis of a problem so that the actual difficulty, whatever it is, gets addressed correctly.
Yes, and I think it's really important that teachers and school personnel understand that they must simply describe the behavior of the student and not assign a cause to the behavior. They can't do that. They have to limit it to saying, these are this is what your child is doing, and it's not acceptable, and you need to deal with it.
And if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, in that process of accurately describing the child's actual behavior, the teacher then may be of assistance in the physician's diagnosis of the problem and the proper treatment of the problem.
Well, and I think that, and maybe this is a point that needs to be reemphasized, that during this discussion, all of the options have to be open. Go see a doctor. If you think, there's a medical problem, you have to check with a doctor, or you might check with a psychologist, or you might, have your child tested to see what the problem is. And are you aware that, do you have any indication that your child is very bright? And if that's the case, then maybe, we need to address that. Maybe we need to challenge. So there are a lot of options open, and it should not be limited to the drug option. That, to me, is wrong. It's a violation, I think, of parents' rights and the rights of the child.
One final, if I may.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, I assume you're aware, Senator, of the huge run-up in the prescription of psychotropic medications for the supposed treatment of ADHD in schools.
Well, yes, and statistically, we don't have that many ADHD children in the population. There are prescriptions written for many more than we know are out there. So there is a over prescription of the drug, and I am anxious to get the representative of the company that makes the drug up here to testify.
Okay.
I'll stop asking questions. Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion, questions? Okay. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your testimony. And let's call forward Lori Wimmer and Chuck Bennett.
Good
Wimmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, here to testify regrettably in opposition to Senate Bill 456, not because we take issue with the Senator's concerns about health and safety of students, but precisely because we do. First of all, as the Senator mentioned, there is a bill, House Resolution 1170, winding its way through Congress, which had very carefully crafted language to avoid doing what I believe this bill may in fact do, which is have a chilling effect on the communication between a parent or and the faculty or school nurse at an individual school about not only the behavior but even academic performance issues related to that child that may have a health-related link. We feel that the language of this bill may not recommend to a parent that the student seek a prescription with the intent of affecting or altering thought processes, mood, or behavior of the student. Explicitly says that you can't have contact with the parent about those issues if it could be interpreted to be that the impact would be if the outcome were that the child ends up on Adderall or Ritalin or what have you for a health-related issue, that if the teacher was the first one to bring those health options to the parent's attention, that there could be in some sort of problem, although the language of the bill is silent on the sanctions. We believe that the federal legislation more carefully contemplated that contact and was a little bit more expansive in protecting the general communication that would be of a helpful nature to parents. And so we prefer the federal legislation because we feel that once that comes down the pike, the Department of the Department of Education could write administrative rules sensitive to that issue so that students are in fact able to get treatment if that seems appropriate, even if it is at the suggestion of school personnel, and not be victimized by a teacher's unwillingness to say anything at all for fear that it would be misperceived or misconstrued. And that's our main objection to the bill as it has come before you today. I will, at the risk of violating my child's own privacy, tell you that I am a parent of a son who was recently diagnosed with ADD. He's now 14 and a TAG student, and we couldn't figure out why his academic performance was suffering when his test scores were so high. And it took us a lot of years and many doctors to finally figure out what was what the matter with him. And if it hadn't been for a series of teachers being very careful about communicating with us what the nature of the issues were in the classroom for him, I wouldn't have ever finally gotten it that I needed to keep looking for a doctor who would finally put him through the tests that would finally reach a diagnosis. And so I was grateful for those communications between the teachers and myself in our son's case. And I just would caution you that a well-intentioned bill could have unintended consequences, and I think that's what this bill would do. Thank you.
Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and representatives from the Oregon School Boards Association also asked me to represent them on this bill. Mr. Chairman, we would just second Ms. Wimmer Whalen's comments on the bill. We are very concerned about the hyper-legalistic environment this will establish, creating, a chilling effect on just basic conversation as teachers and administrators try to determine when they have hit a limit or not hit a limit. I guess the other thing that's of concern with the description Senator Morissette gave of the hypothetical he presented was it would result in, I don't know how to determine that a teacher can prescribe or diagnose in what is an existing medical environment that I think we're all familiar with that has its limitations in malpractice and other areas that I think what he described would be a substantial breakdown in the relationship between a doctor and a patient where they are having a parent come in and say, Johnny's second grade teacher says he needs to be on Ritalin, please write the prescription. That just does not, if that's happening out there, that would be of real concern with the medical system. And I think that may be where this bill needs to focus its attention if that's what's happening. We would prefer to go down the route with the federal legislation and the resulting administrative rules. They have certainly the authority of law. We think that the federal legislation has taken into account a whole batch of discussion regarding this and that it would be a better way to go.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you for testimony. Angie Durashi? And Jim Wittenberg, why don't you come forward as well? Go ahead.
Here. Chair Doyle, members of the committee, my name is Angie DeRoshi. I'm a volunteer for the Citizens Commission on Human Rights of Oregon. And just for the record, the address is P.O. Box 8842 in Portland, 97207. I give my written testimony to the clerk. I'm here to testify in support of this bill, and I'm not going to read my whole testimony. I'll just hit the high points. Basically, Senate Bill 456A is a very simple bill, really. It's just a couple of paragraphs, and what it does, from our perspective, is it opens the door for full and accurate resolution of behavior problems in schools. It allows the school personnel to describe in detail the behavior they're observing in the classroom, and then that allows the parents to really find out what is wrong. By stopping the school personnel short of telling parents and kids that prescription drugs are the answer, you're putting the full power of choice back in the family's hands on how to find and deal with the child's behavior problems. Because, really, the truth is that there are thousands of things that could be causing a child to act out in the classroom. And nobody knows what that cause is until they look. And Senate Bill 456A gives the parents that space to look and find what is the actual cause of the behavior. Citizens Commission on Human Rights operates a hotline where people can call and tell their story of abuse in the mental health system. I could give you several stories of examples. Just a month ago, there was a woman out in East Multnomah County. The school teacher told her that her son was attention hyperactivity disorder. That is an actual disease, that it was an actual disability, and that the agreed upon treatment for that is prescription drugs, and that was what the mother needed to do, was go seek a prescription for ADHD for her son. Prior to that statement, the teacher, the school counselor, the principal, the vice principal had numerous conversations amongst themselves in an internal system that, right or wrong, administrative rule or no administrative rule, has actually established itself. That this internal system generates the conversation within the school, the decision is made that the son is ADHD, the parent was told this is what's wrong with your son and was told to go seek a prescription. She refused. Now this is a low-income mother going through a messy divorce with her husband. She fortunately found herself an advocate to go with her to a meeting with the school. The advocate helped her get in communication with her soon-to-be ex-husband long enough for him to come with her. He is a military man, so he himself arrived at the meeting adamant that the son not be diagnosed or labeled disabled or be put on drugs, because he knows that that boy will never be able to enter the military if he's put on Ritalin throughout his school years. They, together with the advocate, protested with the school district. There was a month left in the school. She ended up pulling the kid out of public school because the people she was dealing with at that school would not accept from her that tutoring, a medical evaluation, other help from a counselor they were already seeing for the divorce and the family counselor that they were seeing. The school team specifically said to her, we will not take that kind of remedy for the son. We know, we have evaluated, your son has ADHD, and they handed her the booklet on the rights of parents of kids with disabilities. She ended up pulling the kid out of school. There's only a month left in the school year anyway, and so that's how she fixed that. Here's another example of a parent that called in simultaneous with the school telling them that their son was ADHD. He was a nightmare, I'll give you that. They gave us that. The parents admitted he has burned through so many schools, more schools than he was years old. But simultaneous to the school going through the process of getting the kid onto, I think, Ritalin in this particular case, he was also being evaluated by a medical doctor. And the medical doctor found out that the kid had a blocked colon. And as soon as that was treated, the behavior went away. A study in the Willamette Week came out a couple of years ago talking about the levels of lead in the paint in Northeast Portland and comparing that with the levels of supposedly ADHD kids in Northeast Portland, and printed several studies on the relationship between lead poisoning and behavior that is commonly misdiagnosed. So the point is, our point is, you have non-optimum behavior, and that is what it is. And Senate Bill 456A just reminds the teacher and the parent and the rest of us that non-optimum behavior is just that. And the conversation needs to be, as the representatives here have pointed out, the conversation needs to be what is causing that behavior. And then a resolution of that cause. I just would like to just take a second to address the concerns from the state. I'm familiar with the federal legislation that's coming through. I don't know that we want to wait for that. I think Oregon can be progressive in passing this bill and making the statement. I don't know if, I personally have not heard from any teachers that oppose this. The teachers that I have become aware of have been supportive of the concept that teachers should not be telling parents to seek a prescription. There, if we think about what's right about teachers telling parents to seek a prescription, there's not a lot right about that. It's the physician's job, it's the parent's job, it's the family's job with their physician, and it's not belonging in the classroom. Right now, there are approximately 6 million children on psychotropic drugs in the United States. Kink Radio is doing a story on this subject right now, and I was speaking to him earlier, and his studies that he got from a national level show that there were 20 million prescriptions written just last year. It's too many. We need to get back to teachers telling parents what's happening in the classroom, parents being able to take all of the options for handling that behavior in the classroom. So we urge your support of Senate Bill 456.
Okay, Mr. Wittenberg, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll open up questions for both of you after you're done.
My name is Jim Wittenberg. I'm a retired pharmacist. I retired my license in the year 2000. I was a pharmacist for 37 years in Oregon, Washington State, and Washington, D.C. I first testified down here in 1969 with Senator Tom Hartung, and we were trying at that point to find a civil commitment process so a young person that worked for him could go into a treatment program without being convicted of a crime, and that was the law at that time. We were able to change that legislation. Again, in 75, I testified on the student government legislation, which would allow students to have part of the collective bargaining process. And since that time, I've not testified on the bill until this year. And I'm not sure if it's because I didn't find something important enough to do or because I just didn't want to go through the process of the legislature again after a very tough session in 1975. If I become emotional about this, it's because I'm the drug dealer. I'm the guy that hands those prescriptions across the counter to those kids, and I watch what happens to them after they take those drugs. And it's not just Ritalin, it's Prozac, and it's Zoloft, and it's Elavil, and it's a myriad of other drugs that we put into these children so we can make them into what we think they should be. Designer drugs, we call them quite often. We'll make the kid a little bit better so he'll get a little better grades, or he'll behave a little bit better, or he won't cause any trouble for us. And it's become all too common to do this. In the 1969-1970 paper, I was written up, and I should pass these out to you. At that time, we wanted to keep kids off of drugs. That was the whole thing, down with drugs. Don't get your kid on drugs. Watch out what's going to happen to them if we drug them. Of course, those were illegal drugs then. Now that they're legal, it seems like that there's a turn around that we want to see how many drugs we can get into these kids. And I wonder sometimes if there's an economic motive to this. Far be it for me to suggest that the drug companies might be profiting from the fact that all of these kids are getting having this new disease called ADHD or ADD or whatever it is. We can invent diseases if we want to, so we can have cures for them. And there's been a lot of suggestion that's what, exactly what's happened with ADHD and ADD. And if you look at what I handed out to you, just one thing I want you to look at is look at the side effects on the back of this page, this piece that Shine has put out about methylphenidate, which is Ritalin. I think it's bad enough that they can't sleep at night quite often taking these drugs, but when you have things like skin rash, loss of appetite, nausea, dizziness, heart palpitations, and headaches, that sounds pretty serious to me. A drug to be given to kids. I sure wouldn't take a drug that did that to me. It gave me heart palpitations. I don't think I'd take that very long. Of course, children can't tell their parents or their teachers that they don't want to take something like this either, can they? So we keep forcing it down to them until a number of them recently has been documented as having heart trouble because of the use of these drugs. AJ was a wonderful little kid. He used to come to my pharmacy up in East Yakima. In 1991, he was a fun kid. You had to watch him because he was spirited. He had a lot of gym and vigor in him. And I asked his mother one day later where AJ was. She says, "Well, he doesn't go out much anymore, and I haven't. I don't like to bring you out in public." And I found out that he'd been put on Ritalin, as had most of every other young boy in that grade school. And AJ finally came in with his mom. He was just withdrawn, quiet little kid that didn't cause anybody any trouble. But his mother told me in tears one day that, "I don't know who my son is anymore. I've lost my son. So we can make him behave at school. They take away this child from her mother." And she cried there in front of the pharmacy. And I learned right then that I, as a drug dealer, was part of this process, and I felt ashamed to do it. We had bottles of 500 and thousands of this Ritalin. I'd never seen those size bottles before. When I was a young guy, we sold 100 of those a week. That was a big week for us in the pharmacy. So AJ finally ran away from home. He didn't want to take the drugs. Went to his grandparents for a while. They tried to get him on the drugs. Finally, he left there, and we don't know, less than when I left Yakima in 95, if he was someplace else. But most every kid in that little grade school, East Valley Grade School, was on Ritalin. And they went around, teachers don't buy words, hyperactive. Well, little boys are hyperactive, most of them. They're fun. That's the way we are. I think every one of my classmates in the third or fourth or fifth grade would have been on Ritalin if we'd had that drug available to us back then, and teachers would have controlled when to control us the way they do. But that's another era. We have ways to deal with spirit here in this country. We want to overwhelm it. Willie White is a Presbyterian minister I hope could be here today in Portland, who related about his son Jesse, who went through Riverdale School in Portland. He went through Westland High School. He went through Wilson High School, Funnyfield Alternative High School, because they wanted to put him on Ritalin. And Woodley didn't want his son put on Ritalin because he knows what happens once they're labeled ADHD or they're labeled mentally ill. That closes a lot of doors for that kid down the road. What's going to happen to him besides the military? That record carries with you forever once you're labeled mentally ill. John Cook was the chief enforcement inspector at the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. When I came back to Oregon in 1994 after my mother's death, I decided to move back to Oregon, help with family affairs. Told me that he was on his way to Pendleton. He said there was a clinic up there that was wholesale writing prescriptions for Ritalin for the schools. And he said that they were exceeding all limits that they could justify. And the DEA had notified him to investigate this. It was amazing what happened, the chilling effect. Within a year, almost no prescriptions were being written for Ritalin in the Pendleton area. Yeah. So it's amazing how fast they dry up once the heat is on and they're watching what the doctors are doing. The same thing happened in Yakima in 1991 with the public to the newspapers and in the news media. The next year, the inspector told me only half of the prescriptions were written. And in the second year, after they did the inventory, there had been a year that I had exposed this publicly. in finding Mark Anderson, a fellow I know, he's a Methodist minister, has a daughter, 14 years of age. I won't give her name because she's still in school. But she said the kids in school that take Ritalin are all called, Ritalin heads or speed heads or something, that they're all labeled because that they take that drug. And once you're on these drugs, all the kids know it, and you become something to mock and something to make fun of. As I said, I was a pharmacist 37 years. I was licensed in Oregon, Washington, D.C., and Washington State. And I finally retired in the year 2000. And quite frankly, I'm just not into drugging children. And the shame that I felt as a pharmacist because of the great numbers of prescriptions, drugs that were putting into kids was more than I could do. I have nieces now, and my nieces have little children in the poor area. I don't want this to happen to them. I don't want them to have the life taken out of them by the Zolofts and the Elvils and the Zyprexes and all these drugs that we think that we can change these kids into what we want them to be. It is a problem. It's a problem everywhere. And, you know, many kids have parents who obviously respect the teachers and the education system, and they don't want to fight that system. If that system tells them their kid has a behavior problem and he needs drugs, he needs help, it's very few parents that have the courage to stand up to that system and get an attorney, which are somewhat expensive, I'm told, to represent these children. It's very difficult to fight the system once you get started with it. And so most parents go along with what the teachers tell them. And if it's drug your kid, they usually drug your child. Okay. I think that if you'll just understand that my emotion about this is that I'm the guy that hands these across the counter. I know what happens to them. I know pharmacists are very quiet about it because we have our $60,000 and $70,000 to $80,000 a year salaries that we want to protect. Believe me, if you talk out against this, you start having trouble very quickly from the Board of Pharmacy and from your employer. So you don't say much about what you're doing to the public. Final observations, I just think that this bill is necessary. We don't know if the federal legislation is going to pass or when it's going to pass. In that time, dozens or and maybe hundreds of young children can lose their spirit. They can lose their ability to have something to go for them in the future. And they can lose their lives by being put on these drugs. So I urge you not.
Thank you. Any questions on this panel? Seeing none, thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Don Stetcher.
Good afternoon, Chair Doyle, members of the committee. My name is Don Stetcher. I represent Novartis Pharmaceutical, the maker of several of these products that help children with difficulties that they're having. I also am a certified teacher for the last 26 years, and hopefully I have some perspective that I can share with you today. The way we see this bill is that it is reasonable and modest, and that teachers should teach and doctors should doctor. And that we believe that if a teacher recommends that a parent have a student see a physician with regard to specific behavior that teacher is seeing in school, that the physician then it would be reasonable and prudent for that physician to prescribe medication to take care of the patient's problem. And we think that these drugs are not for everyone, but they do help some very much. And with that, I will take your questions.
Simple. Questions? Okay. No questions. Thank you, sir. And seeing no one further to testify, Senator Morissette, is there any concluding remarks you have?
Thank you very much for your patience. And I think it's interesting that the representative from the company that makes the drug understands what the problem is. And this is not an anti-Ritalin bill. I mean, if we are, I think there's appropriate diagnosis and application of the medication, and that's great. We're in favor of that. It's the inappropriate use that we're concerned about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And no further questions? Okay, thank you. And seeing no one further to testify, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 456. And committee will stand at ease for just a moment. We'll return to the record on House Rules, or Committee on Rules and Public Affairs, and we will go forward with a work session on Senate Bill 456. Representative Forrest, move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 456 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Forrest has moved Senate Bill 456 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been parsing this bill for the last few minutes, trying to make certain that I understood it and that the wording of the bill was appropriate, especially given the opposition expressed by the by COSA and the Oregon the other association. I'm doing well today, aren't I?
It's the Oregon Education Association.
The Oregon Education Association. Thank you.
Small old group.
That's not one that I ought to forget about, is it? I have a hard time understanding, frankly, what the problem is with the bill. It looks to me as though it's very direct and very straightforward. It is a restriction on one behavior out of a series of possible behaviors that a teacher might engage in. It simply says that the school personnel may not recommend that a student seek a prescription for medication. That's it. The school personnel can engage in any other behavior, including ones that might lead to a student getting a prescription for medication. The issues raised by Senator Morissette, I think, are important ones, and they're difficult problems that we face in an extremely difficult diagnostic arena, in which we have limited resources available at schools. When a child is misbehaving, there are strong incentives to try to get that to stop in whatever method we can. I think it's very clear, based on my own understanding of this issue, that medications are overprescribed without sufficient diagnostic work. Now, of course, most of that can be blamed on the desire of people other than teachers to get that done. I think physicians tend to under-evaluate in the process of diagnosing these kinds of conditions. As a psychologist, I'm aware of the complexity of the diagnosis of these sorts of conditions, even in situations that don't have some obvious physical cause, as one of the other witnesses was talking about the blocked colon problem, which I admit was a new one on me. I see no problem with this bill. I think it's a useful bill. I think it is absolutely beyond the pale if a teacher ever recommends that a student seek a prescription for medication, because a teacher is not qualified to make the diagnostic leap necessary to make that recommendation. In that sense, we're restating the obvious, and I think that this is a useful and appropriate tool.
Okay. Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the concept of this bill is appropriate. I do not like seeing so many of our children being over-medicated, and I think that is occurring. But mental health and behavior problems are a very complex issue, and it isn't the teacher's fault whether a child is over-medicated or inappropriately medicated. It's the physician's fault. And so I hear that there are anecdotal cases where the teacher says you're not going to get back in school unless you're on Ritalin. I'm sorry for that. That should be reported to the school board. And if you're not successful at the school board level, administrative level, you need to go to the Department of Ed. But I do feel, though, that it's the medical profession is letting us down here and not appropriately diagnosing. So for those reasons, I will be a no vote.
Further discussion. Representative Berger.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, that I was unable to hear all of the testimony. For me, the bill, even though there are many impacts, and I do appreciate Senator Morissette's concern about the medication part, but what this bill says, it prohibits the personnel from recommending to the parent. And I can just see this teacher saying, your child has a problem. And the parent says, well, what is it? And the teacher says, well, maybe you should just see a doctor. It just puts the teacher in this bind. We expect so much of our teachers to stay in time, and so limited with the threat of maybe not doing the right thing. And I think sometimes when parents are going through the struggles of a child that is having behavioral problems, they do sometimes can selectively hear, and the teacher would not intend anything by what they might say. And so I'm just concerned in tying this so close to where a person is told what they can and cannot say. I know we're all told what we can and cannot say. Can't ask a person's age, can't ask whether they're married, can't ask a number of things. But I just believe in our schools that we need to let them use common sense and good courtesy. And I, for that reason, I'm going to be a no.
Representative Backman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have read about what I would consider to be over-prescribing of psychotropic drugs for a long time before I heard about this bill or any other bill that would deal with it. And I'm interested, and I approach it kind of like the body is a temple, and we need to be very careful what we give it, particularly these certain medicines. I'm very concerned about any potential negative impact on teachers. I think that would be a tragedy. But I also think that teachers would be, in the event that Representative Berger's situation were to occur, and the parent is talking to the teacher, the teacher would describe in considerable detail the behavior of the child, and would not simply say in a short, rather abrupt way to, well, go see your doctor. I think the teacher would give examples and a kind of a history of what's happened in the way of behavior, and then would bring the parent along and would suggest that the parent see a doctor. I think that would be very responsible and very appropriate. So I am concerned about the what I consider to be, based on what I've heard, not only here but other places, that there is an over medicating going on. And if this bill would help alleviate that, would help reduce that, I would be in favor of this bill.
Further discussion. Well, I guess from my perspective is, I think both the proponents and opponents understood going into this hearing, I was, I think, a little indifferent. I wasn't committed one way or the other. As I started to hear the testimony and be able to focus a little bit more on, what the two main provisions state in this bill, I guess has moved me to support the bill. First is that in Section 1, all it's saying is that the school employee may not recommend that the student seek a prescription. But then right after that, you'll notice, it says nothing in this section prohibits them from communicating with that parent of the student's behavior, if there's behavior problems. And it doesn't relieve the school district of the duties to identify, locate, and evaluate students with disabilities. And, when you start to focus more on really what the law says, I would be very troubled if we have teachers that, look at this kind of legislation and say, because of this, I can't talk to you about your student, because that's not what the bill says. It is clear that they can't recommend that they have prescriptions, but they are certainly responsible, just as Senator Morissette was discussing earlier, for making sure that the parents have full information about their students and what their children are doing in school. And it would be very troubling to me if we hear of those teachers that just decide to say, well, because there's a law now, I can't talk to you about this student, because that clearly is not what it says. So with that, let's call the roll.
Aye.
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 No.
No.
And the chair votes aye. And Senate Bill 456 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Barnhart, wish to carry it.
All right, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Barnhart's carrier. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 456. And colleagues, just to have you hold steady for a moment as I look for unanimous consent to return to House Bill 2857 for the purpose of allowing Representative Flores to vote on that bill. Without objection, seeing none, so ordered. Representative Flores?
Both aye.
Representative votes aye on House Bill 2857. And we'll close that. And with nothing further, we will close and adjourn the House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs.
No.